Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, for our recipes, culinary ideas from around the world, or our latest cookbooks. Now, here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. In 2015, Chef Makini Howell took a sabbatical from her vegan food empire to cook for Stevie Wonder on tour. Today, we discuss her unique take on vegan cooking and what she learned during her year on the road.
Oh, I learned how to cook. I learned how to be a really good cook. I was a chef when I left here, and I was a little bit fancy. But after I left that tour, I could teach you how to be vegan for the rest of your life if that's what you wanted, having all of the good things of life.
Also coming up, Adam Gopnik and I discuss food and literature, and we learn Croatia's secret to perfect cabbage rolls. But first, it's my interview with historian and writer Nadia Bernstein. Nadia, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
We're talking about one of my favorite topics, which is the food industry in America, going back to the beginning of synthetic flavors in the 19th century. So let's get into the weird history.
Sure.
Castoreum. I don't know if I pronounced that properly.
Uh-huh.
But I read that. I always fell off my chair. So this comes from a beaver, and beavers were hunted, I thought, because of beaver hats. But I guess for this, what is castoreum, and where does it come from, and how is it used?
Okay, so let me tell you about how I found out about this ingredient. When I first started writing about and talking about the history of artificial flavors, I'd sometimes get this weird question from somebody in the audience. Somebody would raise their hand and say, "Is fake vanilla actually beaver butt?" And I was, and the first time I heard it, I was a little bit taken aback. I was like, "No." But I looked into it a bit, and The thing that's being called beaver butt is an ingredient called castoreum that isn't actually derived from the beaver anal gland, but from a gland next to the anal gland. So, you know, near butt, but not quite butt. And it's an
important distinction we might want to point out.
Yes, a very important distinction. Yeah. And beavers use it to mark their territory and for other beaverish things. But it has long been an important ingredient in perfumery, as other animal musks have been. And there's a lot of overlap between perfumery and flavors. So historically, it's a very expensive ingredient. You know, once I figured this out, this part of the perfume part of the story, I started answering the question of, is fake vanilla really beaver butt? With, no, beaver butt is way too expensive to be used in fake vanilla.
Was it used for a while for that?
Well, I started looking a little bit deeper into the history of vanilla flavors, especially before the Pure Food and Drug Act. And I saw that sometimes musk would be listed as an ingredient, not specifically beaver musk, just musk, a small amount. And then I started talking to flavorists, especially older flavorists, about this. And one flavorist told me he had trained at one of the big flavor houses in the 1970s. Flavorists, by the way, are the craftspeople, really, who build the artificial flavors or the natural flavors, the flavor additives in foods and beverages. He was a novice, and the flavorist who he was training under made him prepare castoreum extract as part of one of the routine tasks of learning how to do it. So he got kind of this tray of beaver glandular sacs, and he had to turn them into an extract.
What they do to the new guy, right?
Yeah,
on your
totally.
First day, here's some beaver sacs. We want you to extract the compound.
Okay. Well, the master flavorist who was training him said, I had you do that to see if you had the heart of a flavorist. So when it was used in flavors, which was rarely, it was used in really small quantities, just kind of to add a certain nuance, maybe to the very best vanilla flavorings.
They add a certain je ne sais quoi.
Yeah.
Yes, I think.
Also,
probably.
I think it was also used sometimes in raspberry flavorings. Hmm. But what I found was that in the 80s, it almost stopped being used entirely. In fact, I couldn't find anybody who had any memory of ever using it who worked in the industry, for the reason that in the 80s, a bunch of the big food and beverage companies started striving to make their products kosher.
And that beaver butt is not
and
kosher.
Beaver butt is many things, but it is not kosher.
Okay, so let's fast forward to today's world, where artificial is a real problem for a lot of food manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that Trix cereal tried to switch to natural colors and ditched the high fructose corn syrup. And that really didn't work out too well for them because they got really dull colors. So what is the industry doing now that they've created, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 artificial flavors and colors, and now a lot of consumers want products that don't have them?
It really depends on the case. Anybody who's gone to a supermarket within the past 5 years has almost certainly noticed that all kinds of familiar brands now are proclaiming nothing artificial, right? No artificial flavors. Even things where it just seems so ridiculous, like natural Cheetos, right?
Wait, no, so what are all natural Cheetos? What does that mean?
Well, I can't really answer that. In fact, nobody can. Natural flavors are defined, right? If you look on an ingredient list and you see an item that says natural flavors, there's actually, you can go to the Code of Federal Regulations and you can read what that means. It means fruits, leaves, skins, seeds.
From natural.
Yes, exactly. And artificial is everything else. But there's a lot of ingredients that kind of straddle the line, or ways of processing that kind of straddle the line. A major class action court case recently in the past 10 or so years has been about orange juice, Tropicana orange juice. Is it 100% juice? Well, it is, but it's actually juice that's been recombined with flavor packs, right? So basically it's been, everything in it comes from oranges, but it's been processed to a degree that some consumers claim that it no longer counts as a natural product.
So the conundrum here mm-hmm. is what is natural, right? Uh-huh. Because as you said, it may all be derived from a plant or from a fruit, but there's a lot of processing going on. So mm-hmm. it may be natural, but it's heavily processed. The second thing is, if a Cheeto is natural, doesn't mean it's good for you.
Nope.
It's still a Cheeto, which probably is not very good for you. So there's a lot of complexity here in terms of if the consumer wants to eat foods that are good for them, just because it's natural is no guarantee that it's good for you, right?
Right, absolutely. While the definition of natural is still sort of up in the air, it carries so much cultural meaning. We associate it with the kinds of images that you see on the front of packages of foods that call themselves natural, right? Pastoral groves and this kind of harmlessness and this kind of good-for-you-ness, right? That you feel safe assuming that something natural is good for you and also good for the planet. And I think that when you look at the way that the kind of environmental cost, for instance, of relying on an all-natural food chain or things that kind of reasonably fall into what we consider natural, that cost might be much higher than using processing technologies or ingredients that we might consider synthetic. So there's always a kind of balance here.
Nadia, thank you so much for being on Milk Street. I don't know how I feel about artificial, but I know more about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really fun.
That was Nadia Bernstein. She's currently working on a book based on her dissertation, recounting the history of flavor science and the flavor industry. Right now, my co-host Sarah Moult and I will be taking a few of your culinary questions. Sarah is, of course, the author of Home Cooking 101, also star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television. Sarah, before we open the phone lines, here's my question. You're a French cook, or trained French. All the mother sauces you learned, right, in cooking school and in restaurants, do you use any of those anymore or any adaptation of those?
Well, I absolutely make béarnaise all the time. That's a takeoff on hollandaise. That's not a mother sauce, but it's a variation of a mother. And I also make mayonnaise. I like those two very much. I guess that's about it. I make marinara, but that's not the mother sauce.
Okay.
That's Italian.
I think I knew the answer to that, but now it's time to take some calls. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Samantha from Sacramento.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How can we help you?
Okay. Well, I love the taste of sourdough, and a neighbor gave me a sourdough starter that's over 30 years old. It makes good pancakes. It's just not that funky. I'm pretty disappointed. I'm wondering if there's a safe way to make a sourdough starter funkier.
The first thing, which you're not going to want to hear, is maybe you shouldn't use that sourdough starter. All sourdough starters are different, right? So they all have different flavors. So you just happen to have one that maybe is not funky enough for you. So you could start all over again. There are a few things we've learned, though, which does make sourdough funkier. Different flours, like whole grains, flours like whole wheat or rye, will give you more flavor because of the complex carbohydrates in them. If you don't feed your sourdough as often, it makes it a little more acidic and a little funkier.
Okay.
It's like, you know, you have a dog that needs to lose weight. You have to just not feed them as much. And also the liquid that rises to the top of the starter is really sour. So if you really want to make the starter more sour, mix that right back in. The only thing that's typical of bread baking is the slower the ferment, the more flavors developed. So when I make pizza dough, for example, it'll sit in the fridge for 3 days. Then I'll take it out and let it warm up for a couple hours. When you take out part of that sourdough, the starter, and you make a new recipe, when you make the new recipe, if you give it 3 days or 2 days in the fridge, then take it out and let it finish rising, that long period of slow fermenting is a way of building flavor. So those are a few things. But ultimately, you could just go buy a starter, and you might like the flavor better. And Sarah's
I'm completely
grinning.
Out of my league here. I have to be honest, I've never made sourdough bread, and I don't know all the ins and outs.
Well, another place, you know, one other suggestion I make is actually some people were down from King Arthur Flour in Vermont. They have hotlines there with people who actually know a lot about
bread
baking.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
So I would also call them. But that's a, just trying a different starter would be the first thing I would do just to see if you like it. But the long ferment and using some more complex flours like whole wheat, rye, etc., that will add a lot of flavor.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, make sure it's not been sitting there at room temperature for months, though, because rye flour and whole wheat flour do
go bad,
go off pretty
rancid,
quickly.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure it's,
oh,
it's good.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's good to know. So I was wrong in assuming that since the starter is so old that it would be funky, I could get a new one that's funkier, possibly?
Well, sourdoughs are like people. You know, they all have a personality. So it just depends on the starter. Yeah, try a new one.
All right,
okay.
Samantha,
okay,
thank you.
Okay, that's great to know. Thank
yeah.
you so
yeah.
much.
Okay.
Our pleasure.
Such an honor to talk to you both. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
My name is Jill.
Hi, Jill. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Crown Point, Indiana, which is near Chicago. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure. How can we help you?
My question concerns the quality of sugars. You and Sarah talk frequently about the quality of spices and definitely the quality of flours, but nobody ever really talks about sugar. And when you go into the store, the price of the sugar from the local vendor is usually half the price from what you would call, I don't know, the quality vendor,
right?
Which in the Midwest is going to be Domino. Is there really a difference?
That's an excellent question. I remember when I got started in the 1970s, it was a big controversy about beet sugar versus cane sugar. And so I bought beet sugar and cane sugar and couldn't tell the difference in baking. And then I started using palm sugar and coconut sugar and sort of unrefined sugar, like at Whole Foods, for example. They don't sell Domino. They sell something that's less refined. And I use that all the time in baking by weight. And I find there's no difference in my baking. So the short answer is, if you're talking about white processed sugar, I don't think you're going to find a difference in your baking. However, for flavor reasons, coconut sugar, other kinds of sugar, palm sugar, those add a lot of flavor, and they're a nice substitute for light and dark brown sugar, for example. But I don't believe, and I know there's some studies have been done on this, that the brand of white sugar matters in baking, right? I don't think one is more hygroscopic, that is, it attracts liquid more than another. I think it's pretty much the same.
Yeah. I think what is pretty true is Domino is cane sugar and most of the rest of the stuff is beet.
Yeah.
I haven't noticed any difference myself. I'm pretty sure that most bakers do not care.
I'm not the kind of baker who's going to make, you know, the sugar whips on top of things. I just bake bread and I bake cookies and the occasional cake and brownies and things. And, you know, you go out of your way to buy the good stuff and I just stared at the two kinds of sugar and just wondered, does this make a difference? So let me ask the question. You intrigue me with this coconut and palm sugar. When you say it's got more flavor and it can substitute for light or dark sugar, does it have fewer calories of sugar? I'm diabetic, so this makes a difference to me.
I can't answer that question. I would doubt it has less.
Okay.
I use it in my coffee, for example. It just has a lot more flavor. It's very dark brown. It tends to be a little finer. I don't know what the calorie count is.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. If you have a cooking question, give us a call anytime. 855-426-9843. 855-426-9843. Or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Deb. I'm from Wilbraham, Massachusetts.
How can we help you?
My mother's British, and when I was a child, we would wait for the Christmas package to come from our nan, and it always had one of those green cans of Lyle's golden syrup, which we adored. And we would put it on oatmeal, and sometimes my mom would make a golden pudding, which is basically, you know, a steamed cake with a pool of golden syrup at the bottom, which we all loved. So now we can find golden syrup pretty easily. And I like to substitute it for corn syrup in different recipes, like the Millionaire Shortbread, which I've been making long before I knew it was called Millionaire Shortbread, caramel corn and things like that.
Right.
So I'm wondering if there's anything I should be aware of when substituting that in terms of the temperature of the syrup or its liquid base or anything like that, or any other suggestions for it.
We have substituted that golden syrup for corn syrup and a number of things like caramels and stuff that are a little dicey, but it worked out fine.
Mm-hmm.
The one product I've used here is Steen's cane syrup, which comes in a yellow can. which I think is probably closer to golden syrup than corn syrup.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of corn syrup. I don't think it has much flavor. I think you're way ahead of the game by using golden syrup. We don't know of any situation where, like, even making marshmallows, it would make a difference, right, Sarah?
Well, all I would say is that because corn syrup is made from corn and Lyle's is made from sugar cane, and I think it's a little darker in color and a little more, has more flavor than corn syrup really doesn't have any.
Right.
It's more of a sort of molasses butterscotch flavor. Because it's a little darker, sometimes it might be hard to tell whether something is done because it's going to be darker anyway because of the Lyle's that's in there. I'd say that'd be the only problem. Other than that, I see no problem. As a matter of fact, I'd rather use Lyle's.
Well, Steen's cane syrup is probably
the same thing
as
I've
Lyle's.
Never worked with Steen's.
Yeah,
is that from the South?
Yep.
Yeah, I've heard of
you
that.
You can still get it online.
Huh.
I think you're way ahead of the game, and
yeah.
I don't think there's a problem.
I don't either.
It certainly
you're doing the right
flavor
thing.
Profile that we really love.
Yeah, I love butterscotch.
Okay, well, that seems reasonable then. I won't look at any changes. Thank you very much.
Yeah, don't worry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye then.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, we hear from Chef Makini Howell about vegan cooking and her year on the road with Stevie Wonder. That and more in just a moment.
I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like, just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are, and I think that makes it very food friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like, it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet, so it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavors of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded, like, oh, wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just want to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Milk State Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's my interview with Makini Howell. She was raised in a vegan family that's been in the vegan food business since the 1970s. Her Seattle-based restaurants and shops include Plum Bistro, also Sugar Plum. In 2015, she was Stevie Wonder's chef for his Songs in the Key of Life tour. Makini, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you for having me.
So as a former menswear designer, you obviously think about color, and I love this quote about food. You said, there's a lot of color in food, but you have to look for it. So is part of making this food appear delicious and inviting the color and how you present it?
Well, I have a theory on food, like music or anything else that you put yourself into doing. I think that mediums like food are a representation of the individual. And if you look for the brightness and the deliciousness of life, you can find that in plants and you can then replicate that on the plate. So, you know, there's a potato or there's a yam and there's a sweet potato and there's a purple sweet potato and there's so much variety that you just have to look for it and represent it well. And I believe that you should do that in anything you do. I was a designer like that. I think that music is like that. I think that when, you know, when people are truly popular in music, their music represents who they truly are. And I think when you create food that touches people's soul, it really represents who you truly are and what you feel about it, whether it's bright or exciting or craveable or addictive, or those are all facets of the individual that is making the thing, I think.
So here you are with restaurants and food trucks, and you're in the process of opening a dessert place. And all of a sudden, Stevie Wonder comes to you and says, hey, join me on tour. Was that a tough decision or that was a snap decision?
By the time he came in, I had already built quite a good foundation for the business. So it wasn't as trepidatious as just trying to open a store and then right. leaving. Although it's still, you know, the decision I did have to weigh in, and I only had about 3 days, but I do think that the reward was worth it. You know, you just don't know. You got to try. And you got to try knowing that you're willing to risk it messing up, right. But I felt like I should try. And I'm so glad that I did.
So about 10 years ago, I actually catered a Grateful Dead concert, this obviously after Jerry died. And I have to say the experience, although the band was lovely, was very different than I thought. It's not that glamorous being behind the scenes on tour. Did you find the same thing when you were catering for Stevie Wonder?
That was not my experience. My experience was amazing. First of all, I was his personal chef, so I was on a very small team. I was on a team with him and 4 other men. I was on an all-male team. Hmm. I was the next youngest person was like 17 years older than me. So they were a different generation, and Stevie Wonder sang at Martin Luther King. He sang on the March on Washington. He sang right. the Happy Birthday song. So he came from a different generation of people.
Right.
And so back to what I was saying about when you create music, how it comes from inside of you. Every word that he sings on every song that you've ever heard is truly him. Everything that you hear about his love for humanity and how we should be as humans, that's truly him. And that's truly how he treats everyone. So it was an eye-opening experience in that I got to see America through the eyes of a Black American that loves this country, that has fought for this country,
in so many ways for so many years. And so when you travel with someone like that, that means so much to so many people, it erases color, it erases gender, and you see what we actually all hope is there.
Let's talk about you. You write or talk about we were Rastafarian, we were vegan, we were homeschooled. So you started out life early, deeply embedded in the vegan philosophy, right?
Yes.
And is that something that you ever wavered from, or that's just been part of your life so long that that's just a central tenet of how you view food and cooking and living?
It's been a part of my life so long that it is a central tenet. You know, it's when you're a kid and you're like, when I get grown, I'm going to do what I want to do. My mom can't tell me what to do. But right. Then when you get grown, you're like, oh, well, actually, she had a better idea. So what my parents gave me was this thing like 20 years ahead of anybody else having it. And right. So now, as I am cooking in the world, I realize people don't really know what to do with plants. But millennials and Gen Z, those guys refuse to eat anything that has a face. And there's so many of them, and they're looking for something that's good. And it's such a supportive generation, and they'll rally behind you. They just want something. And so many people are so lost as to how to provide it. And so having this thing, it would have been, I realized a long time ago, but I see now what an advantage my parents gave me by giving me this thing, this idea of this plant-based diet and these restaurant concepts and how you can turn this into familiar cultural American food.
What do you think about the burger replacements out there? Do you think that's something that's here to stay and is a good idea or not?
I don't know how long the meat replacement is going to stay. I do think that it's a good idea because I think that what the meat replacement burger does for people is it gives them some familiar substance that helps them to step into veganism a little bit easier.
It's an entry point.
Yeah, it gives them a way to understand veganism versus going from, can you imagine, I don't know if you're a meat eater or not, but can you imagine like enjoying steaks all the time and then somebody telling you, oh no, you actually have to be raw for the next however long. You're going to go into shock. Your body's going to go into shock. You're going to really want that steak. But if you have, you know, a variety of things that can help you get where you're going, it's going to be easier for you to make that transition.
Right.
And so I think that all of the things that exist inside of the plant-based world are necessary. Yes, I do.
Now, you said, I think, that Stevie Wonder had been a vegan for just a couple of years before you started cooking for him. What did you learn about your art cooking for him?
I learned how to cook. I learned how to be a really good cook. I was a chef when I left here, and I was a little bit fancy. You know, I thought I knew what I was doing. I learned how to care for someone, and you learn how to cook when you are on a tour like that, especially when you're an individual's personal chef. So I had to cook breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks. I had to do beverages and teas. After I left that tour, I could teach you how to be vegan for the rest of your life if that's what you wanted. Having all of the good things of life, like, you know, French toast for breakfast or scrambles for breakfast or, you know, I did all different types of tofus and seitans and grains and legumes for dinner. And when you have to cook for somebody every day, you really understand how to create variety and a satisfying meal every day. It's like having, you know, I guess I don't have one yet, but I would assume it's like when you have a family and you cook every day. You know, it's fuel. And so it has to taste good and it has to feel good and it has to hit the spot and it has to, you know, it has to be all of those things.
A few recipes you mentioned, bacon-ish vinaigrette. What does bacon-ish vinaigrette mean?
It's a smoked tofu bacon. So we take a tofu and we smoke it and we call it a bacon. And then I make a dressing with vinegar, stone ground mustard, some fresh herbs. So it's like a smoky vinaigrette.
You also mentioned hillside quickie sandwiches that your mother created. What are those?
tofu sandwiches. So my mom created the first tofu sandwich in the natural food market here in the Northwest. When we were little, she homeschooled us and we worked in our family business. And we had to deliver sandwiches. We were the earthy, crunchy vegans.
So let's assume you're talking to someone who's not a vegan or vegetarian, but is thinking about going in that direction. Do you have a couple things you could say to people about how you would put together a plant-based dinner fairly quickly?
Well, you know, I think that we overthink veganism. I think that all of the things that make regular food good also make plant-based food good. So you have to make sure that you have enough salt, fat, acid, heat.
Right.
You have to make sure that, you know, it's juicy enough, it's saucy enough. And if you know how to cook, stop thinking about it as like, oh my God, I have to cook vegan food.
Right.
Just start thinking about what are the elements that you could replace. Say, for instance, something as basic as spaghetti and meatballs. If you already make a killer sauce, you know, all you have to do is replace the meatballs with plant meat. Replace the cheese with a plant cheese. And boom, you got a vegan dish. So don't overthink it. And don't try to make it too fancy or something that you wouldn't eat. Like, I had this celery root hash. And I was like, that tastes terrible. Do you eat celery root in your regular life? So why would you give that to me as a vegan? Okay. Like, don't give the vegan something that you would not eat in your real life. Think about the things that are good to you every day and start to think about the replacements. And if you think about it, most people eat a vegan carrot. Most people eat vegan potatoes. Most people, you know, there are things that...
You know what I really love about you is you're a vegan with attitude. I mean, you're going like, would I eat the celery root normally? No.
Who would? Would you?
No. It's not. No. That and turnips are not high on my list of favorite things.
No, they're not high on anybody's list. They
right.
don't taste good, not to beat down the lowly celery root. But you gotta work.
Well,
you
puree it with like potatoes, right?
And then good.
Add some fat, and it's a nice dish, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, you got to get rid of that bitter taste. But don't just give a person a bowl of celery root hash.
I like
That's
that.
That's not good.
Good for you. You've made it very clear that the restaurant business can be hell. It's very tough.
Yes. God.
Looking back, you know, what have you learned from this? Were all these things necessary trials you just had to get through to become successful at this? Or maybe you would have taken a different path?
So I think when you have a crazy idea to change the world, you do have to go through adversity. And I honestly think that in a few years, hopefully, we'll change our opinion on veganism. It'll at a point be insane that we ever thought that
right.
it was not okay to be largely plant-based, because
right.
what are we doing to our planet? Like, we all have to live here together. And so I think that the way that things are occurring to us today about some of our archaic thoughts, it will occur to us shortly about how we think about what we eat.
Bikini, what a pleasure having you on Milk Street. Maybe someday we'll sit down and have a meal.
Thank you. I hope so.
That was Makini Howell, owner and a chef at several Seattle-based restaurants and shops, including Plum Bistro, Plum Chopped, and Sugar Plum. In 2013, she published a cookbook titled Plum, Gratifying Vegan Dishes from Seattle's Plum Bistro. Stevie Wonder liked his comfort foods while touring, which made me wonder what other musicians have stocked in their dressing rooms. So according to Taste of Home magazine, Carrie Underwood has three types of hummus. Justin Bieber goes for bread, deli meats, and Swedish fish. Beyoncé loves baked chicken, well-seasoned with garlic. It's Guinness for Will Ferrell. Mariah Carey goes for wine and Gatorade, hopefully not mixed. And Lady Gaga asks for, quote, non-smelly, non-sweaty cheese, plus roast chicken and guacamole. The last time I was backstage, all I got was a cup of tea and an old power bar. So maybe I need to take singing lessons. It's time to head into the kitchen at Milk Street to chat with J.M. Hirsch about this week's recipe, paprika pork stuffed cabbage.
JM, how are you?
I'm doing great.
So this is a story about Zagreb, I guess, because you were just there.
Yes.
I was there in 1971.
A little bit before
you were born, probably.
A bit before my time.
I was changing trains, so I think I had some blood sausage in my backpack. You seem to fare better. You actually had a good meal, so what did you eat?
Yeah, you know, I had to look, though, because in Croatia, you know, meat is not so much a food as a full frontal assault. But with a little digging, I did find sarma, which is the Croatian version of a stuffed cabbage leaf. But it's nothing like any cabbage leaf I've ever had. These were tender and tangy leaves that were not rubbery like I'm used to here. And the filling was meaty and rich and had tons of paprika in it. And it also had the same tanginess that was on the outside in the cabbage leaf itself. It was a completely different experience.
Are these pickled cabbage leaves? When you say tangy, what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. They're fermented. And actually what they do is they do a year-long fermentation of whole heads of green cabbage. Hmm. And then they take those leaves, they peel them off, they stuff them, and they cook them in a very paprika-rich sauce. Incredible.
So if you go to someone's home, there's a big cabbage barrel in the basement of
pickled
cabbages?
Yes, exactly.
And so why is the filling also tangy?
So what they do is they chop up a little bit of that cabbage, they mix it in with the rice and the ground pork, and then they stuff that in, and then they use even more of that diced up cabbage in the sauce itself.
So since we don't pickle whole heads of cabbage
at
Milk Street,
no.
what was our go-to fixer?
Actually, it was an easy fix. We take, just like they do, we take the whole head of green cabbage and we simmer it in seasoned water with vinegar. And the vinegar does the same thing. It gives you that kind of tangy flavor, but it also helps break down the leaves so that they're nice and tender when you wrap them.
So is this the classic casserole where you stuff the leaves, put them in a baking dish into the oven? Is that the method?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, with a whole lot of sweet paprika, we use almost 4 tablespoons for the whole recipe. And we pre-cook the rice a little bit so that it cooks in the same time as the rest of it. And again, the real distinguishing factor, though, is those cabbage leaves. And you tenderize them, you give them a really tangy flavor, and they are fantastic.
Any sauce with this?
Yep, it's using some of the cabbage, just like we learned in Croatia, with a lot of paprika and some of the water that we use to cook the rice, because it's got some nice starchiness to it, so it thickens up as it cooks.
So direct from Zagreb, you had a better culinary experience than I
did
50 years later. Paprika pork stuffed cabbage. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. You can get this recipe for paprika pork stuffed cabbage at milkstreetradio.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Adam Gopnik reveals J.D. Salinger's recipe for popcorn salt and more favorite foods from our literary heroes. We'll be right back. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Christopher Kimball, and you're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, Sarah Moult and I will be answering a few more of your cooking questions.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, my name is Kevin Gray.
And where are you calling from, Kevin?
I'm calling from LaGrange, Kentucky.
How can we help you today?
Well, I have a question that involves something which would seem rather simple, which is hot water. My question is, my wife, when she is cooking, and she's an excellent cook, but when she has a recipe that needs hot or warm water, especially warm water, what she'll do is use water directly from the tap. And I have a question about that because I've had to drain a hot water heater before, and I see all the stuff that
tends
to form in them, all that crunchy stuff. So I guess my question is, because, you know, hot water heaters have, they have a sacrificial magnesium anode, and they've got all this crunchy stuff in them. Does doing this
get into the
materially
food?
Noticeably change the taste of the water? Yes.
Well, not just that. It's just not as healthy. I mean, it sort of depends on your pipes and where you live and what's going on, but hot water dissolves contaminants more quickly than cold water.
Oh.
So, no, I think you are right in that she should not be using the hot water. She should get cold water and then heat it up. Chris?
You're right. The hot water heater, if you ever drained one, and I have,
is scary.
It's very scary. And so you're better off with cold water. We've also done, I've done tests years ago where we were making bread and using bottled water versus tap water. And we could actually tell the difference in some breads. That being said, if, you know, once a month you use half a cup of warm water from
the
tap, it's
not going to kill anybody.
It's not going to hurt anybody. But in general, I agree. You want to use
start
cold,
water, cold water
or use bottled water if it's something where water is going to be an important part of the recipe.
Yeah.
Or filtered water.
Yes.
I've always wondered about that, and I thought, well, I'll just ask the question of you guys.
Actually, I have a question for you. My wife is also a very good cook, and the question is, how do you get your significant other to change something they do in the kitchen? And they actually change without getting mad at you. Do you have a psychological help?
He's got an advantage here in that he can ask us, and what we say matters to his wife.
Well, maybe not.
Whereas what you say to your wife doesn't matter at all.
That's absolutely true.
So I'm sorry. We have to find a different expert for you.
I can say, no, I've got it. I can say, Kevin, I called Kevin, and he said you should use a wok for this recipe, not a skillet.
Yeah, okay. And she'll say, who the heck is Kevin?
Well, I'll just say Kevin's the expert.
The wok expert.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I'll
all right,
use
Kevin,
your name, you use
thanks
mine.
For that, yes.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
All right.
Well, thank you all very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
How do you do? I mean,
he doesn't cook.
I know, but you're married. So you have.
Yeah, he all does those little things, fights. Yeah.
He does things that are annoying. So you obviously have to pick your fights, but do you have a psychological approach that works?
It's very, very indirect.
Smart.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
smart.
So, you know, like one of the things he does is we collect the New York Times and they pile up and pile up and pile up. And, you know, maybe one day I'll sort of accidentally knock them over when I walk by. And he'll
That's
notice. You
very
know. So,
good.
You know, things like that.
But you don't do things like, someone once told me that leaving piles of newspapers around is a fire hazard.
No, that would not work.
Yeah,
he'd
so
see right
advanced.
Through it. Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
Next call. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Marilyn. I live in Mesa, Arizona.
How can we help you?
I started making candies, and I wanted to use up some leftover melting chocolate. And it had a white ash on it that disappeared when I melted it, but reappeared
yep.
when it cooled. And my question is, what is it, and is it bad for you?
It's cocoa butter crystals, which end up on the surface because the chocolate was stored in too cool or too hot a location. You can just eat it.
Arizona, too hot.
Too hot, of course. So don't put it in the fridge, but keep it in a cool, dry place. You can melt it and use it in a brownie, for example, or a cake.
Oh, okay.
But for dipping, for example, that's not going to work because as the melted chocolate cools, the fat structures change permanently and those crystals are going to reappear. It's fine for baking a cake.
Okay.
It's not poisonous.
It's not harmful to eat.
No.
It's just not pretty.
You could actually, I mean,
okay.
sometimes
Good.
I have a bar of chocolate and I'm baking and I notice it's got white and then I can just eat it. It's good news.
Yeah.
I don't have
yeah.
to bake with it.
Right.
It's strictly visual.
I can live with that.
Yeah. I can live with that too. So
well,
don't worry about
okay.
it.
The thing is, you know those beautiful bonbons you get in a chocolate store where the
yeah.
chocolate seems to snap when you bite into it? that's been tempered, this whole process. And the thing about chocolate that's, you know, got the bloom on it is it's not bad for you, but it's going to have that bloom. And also, it's not going to have that snap that you want. You could get regular chocolate and temper it yourself before you use it to dip into. As a matter of fact, Jacques Torres, who's a wonderful chocolatier, he has a method for tempering chocolate in a microwave.
Really?
Yeah, that's really pretty cool. So you might, since we're talking about chocolate, you might want to just Google it and find it and try it sometime yourself to see, because since it sounds like maybe you're going to make chocolate candies again, in which case you're going to want it to be tempered just so it looks nice. But just to boil it down to the simplest, Google tempering chocolate in the microwave
with
Jacques Torres, T-O-R-R-E-S. And he's so much fun to watch anyway.
I think Sarah has a little
thing for,
Jack Torres.
Well, he's such a sweetie pie.
It's that accent. It gets you every time.
I know that French accent.
Marilyn, thanks for calling. Don't worry about the white bloom.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Take care.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Most Street Radio. Now it's time for this week's cooking tip from one of our listeners.
Hello, this is Debbie from Littleton, Colorado, and I'm calling to recommend that you keep the ingredient Vital Wheat Gluten on your pantry shelf. You can order this online, but you can easily find it in the grocery store. Bob's Red Mill makes it, and it's usually in the baking needs aisle right next to the gluten-free item. You can change all-purpose flour into bread flour with this ingredient by just adding 2 or 3 teaspoons to a cup of all-purpose flour. It also is very helpful in whole grain baking, helping those types of breads to rise better. So it's a great ingredient, and I recommend you keep it on hand. Thanks. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to share your own culinary hack or secret ingredient on Milk Street Radio, please go to 177milkstreet.com/radiotips. Next up, let's find out what Adam Gopnik is thinking about this week. Adam Gopnik, how are you?
I am very well, Christopher. How are you?
I'm good. I'm always alert for a new way of looking at the world after I speak with you.
Well, let me try and take you down a previously untrodden path. This all began for me when I discovered J.D. Salinger's favorite recipe for popcorn salt. Now, you know J.D. Salinger, of course. We all know J.D. Salinger, the author of Catcher in the Rye and the Glass Family Stories and countless other classics, who famously locked himself away almost as a hermit in New Hampshire for the last 40 years of his life, forbidding any fans and, in fact, stopping publishing entirely because he was so fed up with the world. But his son, Matthew, organized a little show of Salinger artifacts at the New York Public Library, and I, a huge Salinger fan, wandered in to see what was there. And of the many things that were there, letters to S.J. Perlman, the original draft of Catcher in the Rye, the thing that caught my eye, given my preoccupations, was his recipe for popcorn salt. And it was pinned up there, typed out, and so, being the man I am, I came home and decided that the next time we had popcorn with a movie, we would try J.D. Salinger's popcorn salt. Would you like to know, Christopher, what is in J.D. Salinger's popcorn salt?
Anything fermented in it, or is it free of that?
No, what was so beautiful about it is it was so kind of pure and homey and available. It has garlic salt. It has a little bit of curry powder. Huh. It has marjoram. It has dill. Oh, and a little paprika. Paprika, curry, dill, marjoram, and garlic powder. So I pulled all these things together, being such a Salinger fan, and I sprinkled it on our popcorn, and we sat down to watch a football game. And do you know what? J.D. Salinger's popcorn salt has the same wonderful qualities as J.D. Salinger's prose. It's surprising, it's scintillating, it has an undercurrent of wit, and it's profoundly pleasing. I've never had better popcorn salt.
Really?
This made me think about the whole wider area of what we might call taste by association, meaning food and drink we enjoy in large part because it reminds us of something we've read and admired somewhere along the way. I'm sure you've had experiences like that or favorite recipes that are strongly associated with particular reading.
Yeah. Oysters with Dickens, of course, right? Pickwick Papers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be totally. One right there.
One of my favorites, I realized as I scoured these things, is James Bond's breakfast. Do you remember James Bond's breakfast?
Yes, I do. A soft-boiled egg, Scottish marmalade, and black coffee.
Exactly right. I'm so impressed, Chris. Chemex coffee, which back in the 1950s was very prestigious. And I remember as a kid, a 10 or 11-year-old, reading those novels for the first time. That was by far the most vivid image that the novels gave. I was too young to really care about the Bond girls, but I remember James Bond's breakfast. I was thinking about some other ones that have affected my life. Now, Proust's Madeleine is probably the most famous single thing eaten in the history of literature. But more memorable still are the meals that his characters, the Swan and Odette, eat at the restaurant La Perouse, which is still in business in Paris. And I have gone back to La Perouse exactly in order just to try and be a page out of Proust for a night. Another one that appeals to me is, I don't know if you recall this at all, the seed cakes that the hobbits eat.
Oh, yes.
Throughout the Lord of the Rings. There's lots of feasting in Lord of the Rings, but the only thing that really resonated for me was this idea of these appealing little seed cakes that you would sort of eat for elevenses on your way someplace else. And I never actually got a seed cake until I was spending a day reporting at that wonderful restaurant, St. John, in London, run by Fergus Henderson. And he stopped at 11 to have seed cakes. And they were every bit as good as I thought they might possibly be. And what struck me that all of these things have in common, the things that we actually remember in literature, tend not to be the ones that are the most obviously celebrated, not the ones that are punctuated to be great, like Babette's Feast, for instance, in Isaac Dinesen. No, the ones that we really remember are all popcorn salt. They're all things that we eat in passing, not things that we focus on. The whole image of this gifted, hermetic, super gifted, super hermetic writer sitting down to watch Hitchcock movies, because that's what he loved best of all, and simply composing this popcorn salt for his family reassured me of the deep underlying humanity of J.D. Salinger's imagination.
You're really saying it's almost the throwaway foods in these novels that tell you more about the character than, let's say, Babette's Feast, where it's at the center. I remember my favorite food in Ian Fleming and Bond was he orders for dessert an alligator pear.
Yes.
And it said so much about Bond, he would not eat sweets, right? But he had alligator pear for dessert. And that little detail told you more about Bond than the shaken, not stirred.
Chris, it's so astonishing that you mentioned that, because one of my other favorite moments in Bond was when he orders at one point for dessert, exactly because, as you say, he doesn't eat normal sweets. He orders pineapple, sliced pineapple. And I thought that was the epitome of elegance, right? Alligator pear or pineapple for dessert. It's exactly those kinds of sideways, throwaway things that live most brightly, I think, in our imaginations.
And we should just leave with my favorite comment from the Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. He orders a martini, and the bartender says, shaken or stirred, and he says, do I look like I care?
Yes.
That was a great update.
They were trying to relaunch the Bond character as a rougher, cruder, more relatable, to use that horrible word, character. And that's the way they came up, renouncing his previous drink. I'll still have Bond's breakfast before I'll have Bond's martini.
I totally agree. Adam Gopnik, thank you so much.
Pleasure to talk.
That was Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late or want to binge listen every single episode, please download Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. To learn more about Milk Street, please go to 177milkstreet.com. There you can find all of our recipes, browse our online store, or order our latest cookbook, The New Rules, recipes that will change the way you cook. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, on Instagram and Twitter at 177milkstreet. We'll be back next week with more food stories, and thanks, as always, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer, Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor, Melissa Allison. Co-executive producer, Annie Sinzabov. Associate producer, Jackie Nowak. Production assistant, Sarah Clapp. And production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer, David Goodman.
additional editing from Vicky Merrick, Sydney Lewis, and Samantha Brown, and audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Chewbop Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.